I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today, Kyle, Nathan, and I are joined by Michael Weaver, former All-American at Cal, USAM runner-up, Walker Cupper, and currently playing on the web.com tour. Michael, welcome on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. Glad to do it.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Thanks for being here. I guess we'll get started right away. I read some interesting stuff about you, and one of my favorite tidbits was that you were an elite level go-kart racer.
Yeah.
So tell me about that, and then what made you get into golf?
Yeah, so my dad's always been into racing, and I started down on six. My dad was probably a little bit crazy. One day just started driving go-karts. We had some friends that did that, and I really liked it. Kind of was okay at it to start, and then you couldn't race. Couldn't start racing until you're eight. So for like 2 years, I just practiced basically and got kind of good at it and then raced kind of all over California. And yeah, I was really into it. It was a lot of fun. I mean, as you can imagine, just racing these go-karts, they probably went about like 55 or 60, and it's a bunch of like third grade kids. Yeah. So it was pretty serious. Like, I think some of my parents' friends probably thought my dad was out of his mind. But no, I was really competitive at that. I did that until I was about 12. I started playing golf when I was 10, so I had a little bit of overlap. I was racing and playing golf. And eventually, kind of my dad pointed out to me that I hadn't raced at one point in like 6 months or a year, I think it was. And that I kind of needed to pick one or the other, because if we were going to keep racing, I needed to, you know, be committed to that. And if not, like, that stuff was, he wanted to get rid of the racing stuff. And if I wasn't going to do it, because it seemed at that point, I was pretty set on playing golf. I started when I was 10, just played for like a year, then started playing tournaments, I think, when I was 11. And summertime became, you know, three tournaments a week, like a one day or here, a 2 day or there, all throughout Northern California. So racing kind of took a back seat. And I stopped doing that, yeah, when I was 12, and since then just been playing golf. But I still pretty interested in racing in general. Like, I love Formula One. My dad still races as like a hobby. He has a open wheel race car that I've driven a few times. It's a blast. It's way more fun than golf. I mean, I'm not gonna lie to you.
Have you had more injuries from racing or golf?
I was pretty lucky. Never racing go karts was pretty common that you'd flip. And that never happened to me. So I never got hurt doing that, fortunately. And I've kind of had pretty good luck with golf too. I've never, knock on wood, never really had a serious injury. I honestly can't remember a time where I've missed playing golf for more than really at all. You know, there's been maybe something here or there that's kind of bothered me, but I don't think I could directly attribute that to playing golf or working out related to golf. So I've been pretty fortunate to have been playing for, I guess, 16 years now. You hear about guys periodically, you know, their backs bothering them, wrist, whatever. I have been pretty fortunate that I haven't had to deal with that.
So what are worse, racing parents or golf parents?
Oh, man. Probably racing parents, because they have a bit of a temper. Golf parents are just crazy. You know, they might kind of like snap at their kid, but like, racing, you saw some pretty like redneck stuff. Like, yeah, people literally lost their mind. It was pretty embarrassing for the kids, I'm sure. You know, it was like it was equivalent to like the Little League dad, but I don't think you see that as much in golf, just because it's more, you know, you're competing against everyone else, but less so than in racing, I guess. And you know, you can kind of directly attribute your bad play to yourself in golf, whereas if someone makes a bonehead move racing, you could point the finger at them, you know, with some certainty. So you'd see it occasionally, you know, people get pretty pissed, but not, you don't really see that in golf.
Yeah, I bet you could be like a, you could drive like a jackass and like block people out and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
So in terms of growing up, you grew up in Fresno, and there's like a stable of talented golfers that have come from there, like Watney and Kevin Chappell, Bryson, you know, what is it about Fresno?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I was talking about this with someone recently. You know, you have the guys you mentioned plus Derek Ernst as well. You know, Derek's a year older than me. Bryson is 3 years younger than me. So I played quite a bit with Derek growing up. Played a little bit with Bryson, but we're at a big enough age gap to like high school golf. We're all in the same league, and I'd play with Bryson pretty regularly. But it was kind of a big age difference then. I wasn't real close with him, but no, I don't know what to attribute that to. It's kind of strange because like Kevin Chappell and I grew up playing the same golf course. Bryson and Derek grew up playing a different course, but the same one as each other. Obviously Watney has had a good career. I don't know if it's just like a fluky thing. That's kind of when I was talking to a friend about this, I said, it just seems like a fluke deal. Like my high school team, even we had four or five guys played Division I golf as well at, you know, various, you know, myself and one other guy both went to Cal, Pace Johnson. And then we had a couple other guys play like Cal Poly, Sacramento State. I guess that'd be it. But no, it's just kind of one of those things. It's more coincidence than anything. I can't say, oh, it's because we have all these great courses or facilities or whatever. We can play golf year round, but that's true for anywhere in California.
Yeah, I remember I had Paul Goidos on, and he grew up playing this Muni in Long Beach that like Patrick Cantlay and a bunch of other tour pros have all grown up playing, which is, it's kind of crazy how like sometimes everybody comes from like one course.
Yeah, I could see that where like with our team at Cal, like when you have a bunch of good players all together, everyone's very competitive. I know growing up, all of us were pretty competitive against each other. So maybe that has something to do with it. It's better to be surrounded by people kind of, you know, similar ability. They're, you know, all of us are trying to get to say college golf at that point and push each other, and we all want to beat each other. So that, I'm sure that counts for something. But, you know, beyond that, you know, in professional golf, to have, I guess it'd be five or six guys, you know, Watney's from Sacramento, but went to Fresno State, and then myself, Bryson, Derek, and Kevin, all four of us, either, you know, right, Derek and I on the web, the two others on the PGA Tour. That's, yeah, it's just kind of like an anomaly more than anything, probably.
So you mentioned your team at Cal, which was loaded. I mean, you guys had Hagee, Michael Kim, Max Homa, yourself. What do you think you guys did at Cal to prepare yourself so well to play professionally?
I think kind of what I was talking about, like competition, we were all very competitive. None of us liked to lose to one another. We had this practice facility at Cal, got a course called Metropolitan Golf Links in like Oakland, San Leandro, right next to the Oakland Airport. And we had this huge short game facility there. And there would be days where like nobody really wanted to go practice, but like Michael Kim and I, for example, would say play for, you know, trying to beat each other. And that happened literally every day. We'd go hit balls for like an hour and then have a 2 or 3 hour up and down contest or several contests within a 2 or 3 hour period. I think that's just kind of that element where everyone wanted to beat each other. We all hated to lose to each other. And I think that was worth a lot because I know, say like my recruiting class was myself, Max, and Brandon. And I think that for each of us, Cal wasn't necessarily our first choice going into the recruiting process. You know, you have all these schools you're looking at. Like, it wasn't like it was Cal or then other thing, everything else would be settling. Like I know I was interested in saying UCLA, Stanford, like all the big schools in California. I know Hagee was kind of the same way with, I think USC, and Max is kind of in the same boat as us. There's both of us as well. Like, you know, Cal was on the list, but it wasn't like with all those other programs at that time were higher ranked than us. So it was kind of common. You know, we all heard it, Max, Brandon, and I, that from other coaches in the Pac-12, like they kind of overlooked our class. And then that was kind of a common thing with, even with like Michael Kim as well. It was all these guys who might've been a little bit overlooked. Say Michael Kim was overlooked because he hit it short. Then Max, Brandon, and I had not really like hit our stride yet. I guess you could say we had good junior careers, but not great. And then, you know, they certainly weren't up to par with our collegiate career. So I think it was just, you know, we had a great group of guys. We all got along really well, and we were all really competitive, and everyone was willing to work really hard. I mean, we never had to, there was never anybody on the team that like you kind of had to light a fire under, and like everybody knew where they wanted to be and believed that, you know, we were doing all the right things to, you know, be a top 10 or top 5 team or the number one team in the country.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome and interesting. You guys all had kind of a chip on your shoulder. And
yeah, that'd be a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Something to prove.
What would you say in terms of making the transition from college to pro golf did you like overlook that was like that like maybe is tougher than you would think, like as an outsider?
You know, this is something I took for granted in college that I've just kind of started to realize in the last, say, 6 months or so, is everyone would say like you play a lot more in professional golf than college golf. And I used to think, well, in college I played 13 or 14 tournaments in a school year and then 6 to 8 tournaments during the summer. So playing, you know, 22 events a year. And then my buddy, a friend of mine from Cal, who's a few years older, said, well, I play 25 or 26 professional events a year. And I kind of looked at that like, that's only like a couple more. That's not that big of a difference. But what I kind of overlooked was, in college, your events are 4 days at most. And you have a travel day, practice round day, 36, and then 18 hole day. And then you go home that night. Whereas professional event, it's, you fly on Sunday or Monday, you play practice on Monday, Tuesday, you're either in the pro-am or you're practicing on Wednesday, and then you play 4 rounds and you do that. So like last year I played 30 tournaments, and that's 30 weeks essentially. It's not, you know, it's not 30 call, you know, half college tournaments, half amateur events where it's, they're shorter. So that was something that, I think that's something that's overlooked, is, you know, people look at, oh, it's, you play pro golf, like you get to go to all these cool places, which that's true sometimes. I think if you took an honest look at like the web.com schedule, you wouldn't say like, I'm dying to go to Wichita, Kansas and Omaha and Springfield, Missouri, or
Springfield, you know, Illinois.
I've played, you know, it's like the courses are good, the tournaments are well run, but that's like, people think that professional golf is like, oh, you're going to all these cool destinations, you get to do cool stuff. Well, like the reality is, like I'm going to try to make time to go to the Panama Canal this week because I've never been, but most weeks, like I'm not doing anything touristy. Maybe I'm just lazy about that or not. It's not that important to me, I guess. But most weeks, like there's just not a whole lot of time, because you got to play your practice rounds and then you practice and you work out and whatever else you have to do to get ready to go on Thursday. I think that's something that's so easily overlooked, is the tournament, or it's 4 days, but you know, being ready to play a tournament involves a week, and you have to, at the level that, if you haven't won on the PGA Tour, I guess the way I look at it is you need to play pretty much every chance you get, because you can't really like be complacent, because it's so easy to, if you're like a rookie on tour, sorry, it's not easy, it's so difficult to get into events. You're kind of forced in your rookie year to play the events you get into rather than, you know, picking your schedule, which, you know, you kind of have to take advantage of that. Then say in your second or third year, once you, you know, move up in the world ranking, or if you win a tournament, then you can have that luxury. But I think that's something that is probably the most overlooked, even for guys who play golf necessarily in college, let's say. I'll say, oh, I don't want to play more than 2 events in a row for an amateur schedule. It's like during the summer, it's like you need to kind of get used to playing 4 or 5 in a row, because you might have no status Monday into a web event and top 25 a few of them. And then all of a sudden, like I had a stretch this summer, I was planning on playing a couple weeks on, a couple weeks off, do that, and then like six tournaments over like a 9 week stretch. And the weeks I had off, I Mondayed into a web event and combined that into 9 straight weeks. And that, you know, after 9 weeks, I was sick of playing golf, but that's kind of the nature of it. You know, you kind of have to go when you're hot and keep going. And that's
kind of the deal. Speaking of playing a lot of golf in a small amount of time, obviously you had a great run at the USAM at Cherry Hills. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that was kind of a surprise more than anything. I knew like my game was going in the right direction and I was improving, you know, I was working hard, but I was kind of having a bad summer before that. I played really poorly at the Western at North Shore, I believe, like 2 weeks before, and I was pissed at how I played, and I was like, I went home and practiced a lot. It's like I hadn't really done anything too redeeming that summer, I felt like. So I figured, oh, hopefully I'd qualify for the AM. That was really the only highlight, I guess. And I think that was my second US Amateur. I played at Erin Hills the year before and missed the cut by one there, missed the playoff by one. So I was kind of like fired up to go to the AM. I didn't know anything about Cherry Hills in particular, other than it was at altitude and in Denver. I mean, I knew about, you know, like Arnold Palmer playing there, and that I'm not a huge like golf, like history junkie. So that was about it. And yeah, I played played Cherry Hills first, then played Common Ground. And God, I made like a double or a triple on my 10th hole at Common Ground, I remember, and was I knew then I was probably outside the cut line. And I want to say I birdied like three of my last seven or eight, got in to the playoff, which was 17 for 14, bogeyed the first playoff hole, went on the next one, then parred that and birdied the 12th hole. At Cherry Hills is like a par three over water. It's about 200 or so, or 210. Then I had quite the draw in match play. I felt like I played a lot of guys who are doing really well right now. So now looking back, it's kind of a cool thing to think about. I played Zach Blair in the first round. I think I won 2-1. Played Patrick Rogers in the second round. Beat him, I think, 2-up. I played Alvin Choi in the third round, and I never led that one. I was trailing all day, 118 to get to a playoff, and then got up and down from a bunker, the front bunker on one for birdie to win. So that was kind of dirty. I like felt like I stole that one. And then quarters, I played Ricardo Gouveia, plays on European Tour now. Semis, I played Justin Thomas, and then lost to Stephen Fox on the 37th hole. But all in all, no, it was a sick week. I mean, I had my dad caddying for me. We had a blast. It was obviously a really cool experience for my dad and I to share together. He'd caddy for me periodically, and just to for me, and knowing that I was in the Masters and the U.S. Open the following year was a pretty incredible feeling.
What was it like to play in the Masters and U.S. Open?
Yeah, so the Masters, I was really nervous, really excited, obviously. It was, you know, everything I expected and more. I mean, the course was, you know, incredible. I made two separate trips out to Augusta prior to the week of the tournament. I went in January once, and then I went in March. Yeah, so it was like kind of everything I had expected and more. I mean, it was just, I got to play 10 rounds or so prior to the tournament week. One of those, Ricky Fowler, was there one day, so I got to play 18 holes with him, which that was actually pretty helpful because I kind of got the wow factor, whatever you want to call it, like shock and awe of playing with a big name player out of the way before the practice rounds or the tournament started. So, and then, yeah, I played practice rounds with some pretty good guys. Played with Watney and Luke Donald one day. Played with Duffner another day. I played with Fuzzy Zeller for 9 holes, which was hilarious. And then I played the par 3 contest with him as well, and Hubert Green, which was pretty cool. We got put, like, not put on the clock, but we got told to stop signing stuff because we fell about 2 holes behind because Fuzzy didn't miss a single person. I played with McIlroy that day as well for 9 holes and Robert Garrigus. So no, it was incredible. Then the US Open, that was pretty cool. Doesn't quite compare to the Masters, I don't think. I think part of that just because it's so difficult to get into the Masters, whereas the US Open, like, you can qualify for it every year. It's obviously difficult, but it's much more attainable. And that was a pretty cool experience there, though. I made the cut there. Didn't play great on Saturday, but I had my dad caddy for me there as well. So that was also like another really cool experience, like finishing on Father's Day. Having my dad caddy for me was definitely a something pretty cool that we could share together. So no, I was fortunate. We got to play Marion too, which was, I thought, a really cool course. And it was interesting playing practice rounds there. Guys were saying, or sorry, TV was saying, this course will be easy. It's short, whatever. I remember playing with Bill Haas and Nick Watney, and I was worried because I didn't think the course was that easy. And I asked Bill Haas, like, what do you think about this course? And I was going to be really concerned if he said, oh, I think this is going to be pretty easy. And he goes, I don't know what the hell TV's talking about. These guys haven't been out here. They haven't played it. And sure enough, that proved to be right. I mean, one over one, the cut was 8 over par. It was like a early 2000s US Open.
So if you were building a course that was going to challenge like the professional player, how would you build it to have a winning score around par?
Probably have, it'd need to be kind of narrow. Like that's sort of the thing, off the tee, longer off the tee. And then you wouldn't need longer, like little or no rough around the greens. Like, but you need stuff like Chambers Bay, I feel like, where it's just kind of ball runs away from the greens. You get way below the level of the green. Cause that's the hardest to chip out of, rather than if I'm in 4-inch rough, like a foot off the green or 5 feet off the green, even as long as I'm not like really short sighted, doesn't usually get away from you too much there. You don't get like, you don't chip it up, have it roll back to you. I think that's something that, like, long rough, that's like the difference between like what amateurs, like that just scares the heck out of them because they can't putt out of it. Whereas if it's like, you got a collection area that's 6 feet below the edge of the green and it's really firm, like that's just really tough. Like you can't, hard to hit it high with spin. You can putt it up, I guess, but I've never really liked doing that. I mean, I think narrow is kind of narrow off tee, long rough. That seems to be the thing that keeps guys from getting too low. Cause you know, if you just bring the fairways in narrow enough, that's pretty much what they did at Marion. The rough was long around the greens as well, but, say if they had a bunch of runoff, say like if it was like a Pinehurst around the greens there, I think it might've been tougher than just if you run one through the green, ball stops pretty close to the pin, you can kind of hack it out to 10 or 15 feet, hopefully, and be fine.
Yeah. I always say like the worst thing for good players to see is the ball like rolling away on like approach shots, like the ball rolling in general, because when it's in the air, you pretty much know how far it's going to fly, how it's going to, but then if it rolls away, that's when it, like, you know, you've lost control.
Yeah, you feel totally helpless. It's like, you know, your ball, you see your ball start spinning back down a ridge. It's just like, there's like no worse feeling. Mm-hmm. And okay.
Did you learn anything from your two major championships you played in at Marion and Augusta that you still use today?
Maybe more just like the confidence that I've like been there, to where if I'm back in that position, it'll be familiar, and that know that, it's just something I'd be more comfortable next time. Like just the difference from the Masters to the US Open, how much more comfortable I felt. I mean, when I teed off the first hit at the Masters, like I hit my first tee shot. I had no idea where it went. I was so nervous. I couldn't have told you, sort of thing. And then when I started at the US Open, I wasn't nearly as nervous. That was something that you just, with anything, the more you do it, the more comfortable you get. So I think that was a big takeaway. And obviously I wanted to play with like big name guys, just more like curiosity than anything. See what their game was like. And yeah, you know, I mean, I know that guys hit bad shots and all that, but when you watch on TV, you don't see that. So it was kind of cool to play practice rounds, talk to some guys that I played with, see what they did. And you realize that it's not like way different than what you're doing. They're just, their bat is just a little, it's just better. Like everyone can play really good golf. It's just, these guys aren't as bad when they're bad.
What's the area of your game that you've had to work on the most since turning pro? Like maybe an area that you didn't think was that you didn't think needed a lot of work, but you've had to work on a lot.
Probably like distance wedges. That's something that I've kind of starting like middle of college, I started working more on. I wasn't very good at it all early on in college. So that's something just, I guess it kind of started the end of my college career, but that's something I've been pretty diligent about because I don't hit it really far, but I hit it above average, I'd say. And, you know, I have more of those opportunities, and you watch guys who, and I'd play with guys in mini tour events who like poof it, hit it like 265, 270. And we'd play these 6,700 yard courses and they would just like rip it up. And that was something that just like drove me freaking nuts. And because it felt like I like an advantage I had was being taken away and being replaced with something I wasn't very good at. So that's something that I'm probably the most diligent about practicing right now that my coach and I are working on.
So you played in Latin America. Speaking of some of the mini tours you played on, you have any crazy Latin American tour stories?
Yeah, I do. It mostly involves other people doing funny stuff. I mean,
right.
I have one friend in particular who has played, as far as I know, at least two rounds without going to sleep. Yeah, went out one night, didn't go to bed, showed up at the hotel when I remember I was first off, this was in 2015, and he did it again this past year. And let's see, in 2015, the one in 2015 was really impressive. We're playing this course in Central Argentina, Cordoba Golf Club, it's called. It's kind of like Paso Tiempo, but really narrow.
That's Cabrera's home course, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's final round and it's blowing like 20 all day. I'm like first off. So I kind of like luck out with the draw. It wasn't that windy when I played. I played well. I think I shot 200 and like four or five other guys did as well that day. And I was low score. My buddy went out with the guy I was rooming with that week. And the guy I'm rooming with says, "Hey, I'm going to crash in someone else's hotel room tonight. So I don't wake you up when I get back." I was like, sick. Thanks. Cause in Argentina, like, you go to the bars at like midnight or one, you stay till the sun comes up pretty much. And I was teeing off at like 8. So I leave for the course. My roommate's not there. And I don't think anything of it. And he went out with my friend who had like 30. They got out at 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning. And he had to like grab his stuff and bolt to the course. No warm up, nothing. Goes out. He and plays in the wind, shoots like one over. I think that's probably one of the best rounds I've ever seen. So I didn't see it, but like that I heard about. I mean, I'm pretty sure he probably wasn't hung over because he was probably still drunk when he teed off.
Right.
And, that he did that again. I can't remember where.
Or Buenos Aires Jockey Club.
Oh, the Argentine Open.
man, he loves Argentina.
Yeah.
Buenos Aires is a little bit better than Cordoba.
Yeah, yeah, I did it. Yeah, this about 2 months ago. So oh wow! He double hit his second, double hit a putt, and still shot one under on the first hole.
Jesus, so, this guy's got all the talent in the world.
But the guy I'm staying with this week would room with him periodically, so he's laughing. Let's see. Then I don't know. It was just stuff like that, and then there was always. There was always like some hustle, like some caddy was wanting more money. There, I think, kind of the stuff involving players was just usually more interesting because you got a bunch of guys like running around, kind of the Wild West. I mean, you kind of forget they're third world countries, and you know, I never felt like concerned like safety wise, but it was just something you had to be aware of.
What's worse, the caddies on the Latin America tour or the scorers in the Bahamas for the Webb event?
Oh man, the scorers in the Bahamas, because at least in the Latin events, like certain countries, you know, you'll get decent caddies, like Argentina, Colombia, where like the countries where their more golf's actually popular in South America, they'll have decent caddies. They usually at least know where to stand, which is the biggest part of it, but. I mean, the people in the scores in the Bahamas the last couple of weeks were outrageous. I mean, the first round at Abaco, the second event, my group, the rules official came up to us on the 12th hole. We teed off on 10, and he says, "None of you guys made a hole in one on 10, right? It's par 3." The walking score, put us all down for ones. And I made a triple on the next hole. She put me down for a birdie. I was like, I wish, but
they need those guys. They should have that crew travel to every web.com event.
Oh, it's like, it's kind of like a waste that they do it. Like, cause like in Latin America scoring, they just get a volunteer every 3 holes and you tell them your score. And it was never that bad. Like my parents would follow along and, you know, my dad would say, "Oh, they had you for a bogey on this hole, but you made a par," or vice versa. Like maybe following my round every, they'd do 3 hole scoring, kind of like college. And that seemed to work good enough. Like it was never, you never had anything too wild. But I mean, the Bahamas, it's just like, I'm not really sure what the strategy is, but it's clearly not working. I mean, they kind of doubled down on it this year too. Cause I remember last year it was the same way.
That's what I was saying on Twitter, is like, they just need to suspend the live scoring down there. Cause I remember I was tracking it last year and I was like, my buddy was like, they had him for like 1 under and he was like in 5th place. And then he signed for like 84.
Year at the turn, they'd take our card and like snap a picture with their phone. And I guess they'd use that to put it into the computer. So I think you would see guys' scores correct at the turn, I'm guessing. But yeah, I mean, I think I saw like Lee McCoy tweeted during one of the delays the first week. It said something. He was like 5 over on the PGA Tour app, and he says, "I'm 1 under right now." It's like, how? I just don't know how you could get that far off. And like, yeah, they're blowing it on par 3s. It's just so simple. Like, there's not even that much to keep track of.
Everybody like having a hole in one
shot involved, but yeah, it really made you question like what was happening in these people's minds.
How did they get this job?
What was your favorite stop on the Latin America tour?
I liked Lima, Peru, just because the course was good, not great, but it was just the event was really well run. Lima's kind of a cool city. Bogota is good in general, so we usually play decent courses there. I know the golf courses in Argentina were good, but I was never really a huge fan of Argentina. They eat dinner really late there. That was kind of a hassle. You'd play at 7:30 in the morning and restaurants open at like 8 or 9 PM. So probably, yeah, Lima, Colombia, those were good. Cause you kind of got to stay in the city. When we're in Central America, you stay out in these like resorts, you're like stranded and you're stuck. You can't really go out and check anything out. I was more interested in like the other stuff, like at least kind of see. So I looked at, you know, playing in Latin America, I was going to a bunch of places that I kind of figured I never would. So it's kind of interesting to check it out, especially the first year around in 2015. Like every week was kind of a new adventure. Like, go check this place out, just see what it's like. The courses were just really hit and miss there. Central America, you'd have all these like huge resort courses with lots of lakes and huge fairways and nothing special. And then Argentina, you'd have some good courses, but Argentina was just kind of blah to me.
What was the pace of play like out there? I know that, you know, golf Twitter had a breakdown last night.
I didn't see what happened, but I mean, I read about it. Apparently it took JB Holmes 4 minutes to lay up, and I'm not sure what happened with Alex Noren, but apparently it affected him. He
had that second shot on 18, you know, from whatever it was, 230, and you know, obviously he was going to go for it, and JB took the 4 minutes to sit there and decide what he was doing. So Noren was sitting there like, you know, the tournament on the line, twiddling his thumbs. But
right. Yeah, I get that part. I would have just told, if I was in Alex Noren's shoes, I feel like I would have at some point just ejected from the weight and told JB I'm hitting. I'm a bit impatient, so that would have driven me up the wall after about a minute and a half, especially if he has an iron out laying up. Pace of play on Latin was usually pretty good. They did a decent job of policing it, I felt like. I mean, you'd know there's some guys who are just like a human rain delay that you knew going in. Like, if you have to look for a ball or something, you're probably going to get put on the clock. But I don't know. I mean, I get the pace of play thing. And the pace of play down here, in Latin America, it was fine. I mean, they put you on the clock, but the way they police it in general, I just think is it doesn't really, they're not solving any problems. You get put on the clock and everyone just speeds up. So if you get put on the clock, I think it's 10 times in a year on whatever tour it is, you start to fine start at 10, timings, whether you get a bad time or not. If you get put on the clock enough, you'll get fined. But the fine at each level is like kind of a joke. Like, say it's worth paying the fine and if it doesn't affect you playing faster. You know, if you have to try to speed up and it affects, you know, it costs you a shot or two, like, that's worth way more. Cause like, I think in Latin they fine you like $250. Web, I'm not sure what it is on the web. I know like PGA Tour, I think it's like 10 grand, but
yeah, you know, if that 10
comes, what's that?
A shot's worth way more.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, if I get put on the clock and I'm in the second to last group at a tour event, like if they're going to fine me 10 grand, like whatever, you know, that's
right.
Yeah. Like one shot is worth $50,000 to $200,000 depending
on how
poor you are, you know? So until they start like actually penalizing guys with strokes, and I don't know the answer to this, but you know, I got put on the clock in the Bahamas and I know I'm not a really slow player and everyone sped up. So like, even if I was playing with guys who were slow, everybody sped up. Like the rules official didn't witness anyone playing slow. It's kind of like, it's a total waste of time. It seems like that the way they're going about it, I don't know how you improve it, but I know that finding guys cash is not it's probably not the best disincentive to make them play faster. You know, I think I look at how well AJGA did timing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're like, they instill like the fear of God in the kids. Like if you got one red card, you were hauling the next three or four holes. Like you never saw anybody get a penalty. And obviously they couldn't find the kids, and penalty strokes sure seemed to work. I mean, we'd play AJGA events in 4 hours and 10 minutes. And now we play, you know, I consider a 4.5 hour round in a tournament to be pretty quick.
Yeah. That's the way I feel in AM golf. I'm like, wow, I played really fast today. I mean, I look at my like phone at the end of the round, it's 4.5 hours.
4:30, yeah.
So let's get out of here with some fun questions. No more like, you know, pace of play. we'll do one last question and then we'll get into overrated, underrated. All right. So we talked about your Cal team earlier. If you could take like one part of any of your teammates' games, what would it be?
I don't know. It's a toss up between Michael Kim's putting and Hagee's length.
I figured Hagee's length.
Two good things. Yeah.
Oh man. I'd probably take Hagee's length. I mean, Michael Kim putts it really good, but Hagee's a joke. I mean, I mean, my ball speed's like 175. His is like 187 or something. Like, I'd be top 20% ball speed, and he's just 12 miles an hour faster. Like, that's a joke.
He murders it. Walked with him one day at a web event in Chicago, and God, he kills the ball. It's crazy. All right, we'll do some overrated, underrated. Overrated, underrated, Northern California.
Like for golf or?
Just in general.
Underrated, only because Southern California is so overrated.
That's a good answer.
Relative to California, it's underrated.
Let's go overrated, underrated, Panama. Which you're there now.
Oh man. Probably underrated. I mean, this is like the perfect spring break stop. There's like, you can get yourself in all sorts of trouble. It's cheap. There's you could have all kinds of fun here. And probably underrated.
We'll have to see on Saturday who misses the cut there.
Yeah, right. It'd be a good week to be a fly on the wall for guys that probably.
How about overrated, underrated, the crow's nest?
Oh, man. It's not over.
You don't want to get yourself in trouble?
Not underrated.
Gotcha.
Properly rated. I'll leave it at that.
The political it's answer.
Something you have to do. But when I was there, I stayed there a couple nights. I'll elaborate. Doesn't matter. I mean, I stayed there a couple nights, and it was like I just kind of hung out there. Like I like golf. I'm not like a huge the history part of it to me. It's cool, but like I don't have the greatest appreciation for it, I guess. And I think it would have been. I might have felt differently. Like when I was there, the only guy that was staying there was the 14-year-old kid, Guan, and he was like doing homework the whole time we were there. So I was just laid up on the couch watching TV on like the 13-inch TV they have in there, like hanging out. And my family in the house were there. I was texting my friends, like, what are you guys up to? I was kind of bored. And I was supposed to stay for 3 nights, ended up staying for 2. Because, like, Stephen Fox and TJ Vogel and Nathan Smith were all staying there different nights. So, kind of like the camaraderie wasn't there, I guess you could say. But, I mean, it was cool. Like, don't get me wrong. You have to do it. It's just, that's part. If you play as an amateur, like, that's, you got to do it. And I'm glad I did. But I have a lot of people ask me about it. And I always tell them, like, yeah, it was cool, but you know, I could say I did it, but that's about it.
All right, last one. Max Homa's Twitter game.
Underrated. His Twitter game is pretty good. I'll read what he says sometimes and think, oh, that was. He has some pretty strong takes at times, but he's pretty funny. I that's one thing with Max, like, gosh, what was he? He had a good one about the Browns, the NFL team, a couple weeks ago. Someone equating the NFL's ratings and Donald Trump and the Browns. And Max is not into politics at all. He says, whoever the guy was, says, I'm not a politics man, but if you should watch a Browns game on TV and then think, after what you saw, would you pay money to go watch the Browns? Because the picture was, you know, after, with all the political stuff with the NFL, stadium's empty. But the Browns at this point are like 0-9 or 0-10 at least. Would you go and pay to watch that after watching it on TV? It's like that was probably one of his best I've seen in a while. I get a kick out of some of the stuff he puts on there.
I feel like he's at his best when he weighs in on really random subjects.
Yeah, he's really into pop culture, I'm not too well versed in, so some of it I feel like I probably miss. But there's always some off the wall thing that, like, you say it's like an award show or whatever. Like, he doesn't miss a beat. If he has a pretty broad range of content on his Twitter account.
Yeah. All right. Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on, and we'll look forward to seeing you play well this week and this season on the web, and hopefully up on PGA Tour
next year. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Go get a win this week. That'd be pretty cool, huh?
Yeah. Thanks.
Stay in your hotel room at night.
I will definitely be sleeping before all of my rounds.
All right, man.
That's good to hear.
Thanks. All right, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.